Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, hunters wade into the Florida Everglades to kill a predatory python.
Many people here, including the authorities, underestimated how quickly the snakes would multiply, and so they failed to act fast enough to stop them from becoming fully established in Florida's Everglades.
The Indian city of Bhopal struggles for survival 30 years after a catastrophic industrial accident.
Some of these chemicals are heavy metals like lead and mercury. You know, mercury is a neurotoxin. Some of these are teratogenic chemicals. Basically, it will go through the placenta barrier, so it is potentially causing damage to unborn.
And a farmer in Scotland builds a recycled home out of materials he found in the countryside.
Being a farmer, I'm very conscious of the nature and the environment. You don't own land, you're there as a caretaker for the next generation.
I'm Saroja Coelho, welcome to the show. We begin today's show slithering through the Florida Everglades alongside a powerful predator. Imagine a very large, heavy-bodied snake, dark brown with beige blotches and two distinct lines that run horizontally across the head. The Burmese python, elegant, powerful, deadly. This snake is one of the largest on the planet. They can grow as long as 7 meters and can come to weigh as much as 90 kilograms. Their girth is as big as a telephone pole. The Burmese python actually comes from the jungles and grassy marshes of Southeast Asia, but they've been transported by human beings to the swamps of the Everglades in the U.S. This is where they have been flourishing, in the warm, wet habitat. They have been eating everything in sight and are even challenging alligators for top spot on the food chain. So Florida officials have asked locals to help them hunt this troublesome invader. Hundreds have signed up for the month-long challenge. DW's Anya Cooper's met with a python hunter on his way into the Everglades and has this report.
Now, see this area here? That's prime for a Burmese python. I'm thinking there's a snake, some kind of snake in that bush right there.
Barefoot, wearing a leather Crocodile Dundee-style hat decorated with alligator teeth from an alligator he caught himself, Jim Ferguson is a Florida native and a real-life python hunter.
I have an arsenal of weapons. I have snares, gigs. I even got a pistol that shoots shotgun shells, which comes in pretty handy. But the best thing to do, basically, is grab them by hand and then bag them up.
Aren't you scared?
No. I love that stuff.
Ferguson is the kind of person Southern Florida needs more of right now, because the threat posed to the state by this jaws of the snake world has never been so great. An invasive species that can grow to more than 5 meters in length, with no natural predators to control them, Burmese pythons became established in the Everglades as a result of the exotic pet trade. Nearby Miami is the major port of entry for exotic plants and animals from around the world. Some end up being released into the wild by their owners, others escape into the wilderness after one of Florida's famous hurricanes. The result is that Florida's native fauna are under threat. Burmese pythons eat mainly small mammals and wading birds, but their formidable size even enables them to sometimes swallow alligators and fully grown deer.
I was at an area between Marco Island and Naples. It was a state wildlife area, and I saw a Burmese python crossing the road.
Jerry Jackson is a professor of ecological sciences at Florida Gulf Coast University.
Its head was on one side of the road, its tail was on the other side of the road. In vegetation, it was an exceedingly large individual.
Burmese pythons are not only big, they're also extremely reproductive. The largest one caught so far last year contained 87 eggs. Dr. Jackson says many people here, including the authorities, underestimated how quickly the snakes would multiply, and so they failed to act fast enough to stop them from becoming fully established in Florida's Everglades. It may now be too late to stop the damage they cause, he says.
This is an animal that not only is a threat to natural ecosystems, it could be a threat to humans, to young children. We see them in city parks on occasion. It could very easily be a predator on a small human.
You can help the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission limit the impact of Burmese pythons by participating in the 2013 Python Challenge.
The 2013 Python Challenge is an attempt to stem this threat, to educate the public about the problems caused by Burmese pythons, and to provide more information about the animals for research.
During this month-long challenge, competitors will harvest these snakes and compete for prizes for the most and longest Burmese pythons caught.
Florida Wildlife Commission spokesperson Jenny Ketelin Eccles admits the government is under no illusions that the python challenge will lead to the elimination of Florida's Burmese python population.
We think at this point it's highly unlikely that we would ever be able to completely get rid of pythons because they are in the Everglades, which is a very vast wilderness area, and much of it is very hard to access. So even though there could be as many as 400 people participating in the Python Challenge and out in the areas during that time, there's still going to be large portions of the Everglades that people are just not going to be able to get to.
No matter how daunting the task ahead, python hunter Jim Ferguson isn't afraid of getting out there and doing the hunt. Jennifer, his fearless 18-year-old daughter, is also a keen python hunter, and together they make a crack team.
Like, if it's a really big snake, like the 10-footer, then I'll help him out, obviously.
She takes the back end. And when you do catch them, they send out a musk out their rear end that is super stinky. So she gets the stinky end, I get the end that bites.
And you don't mind that?
It's okay. Yeah, perfume can cover it up.
The Python Challenge ends on February the 10th, and an awards ceremony will be held on the 16th of February at the Miami Zoo. Jim and Jennifer are hoping they'll bag enough of the big snakes, or perhaps even the biggest, so that they'll both be invited. Anya Coopers, DW, Florida.
We leave the python-ridden swamps of Florida now and climb high into the Andes. For centuries, pilgrims have traveled to Peru's Sinacara Valley to perform sacred rituals at the base of its enormous glacier. The rituals date back to the time of the Incas. They regarded the glacier as a source of holy water. There is dancing and prayer. Pilgrims take home blocks of ice believed to have medicinal value. But as the earth warms, the glacier is melting. Now, that water isn't just important for the spiritual lives of the people here. Peru's Pacific coast would be a desert if it wasn't for the water flowing down from the Andes. And most of the country's people live here in the Peruvian capital, Lima, one of the driest cities in the world. Nearly a million people in the city are without adequate access to safe drinking water. Instead, they depend on makeshift wells, which often attract rats and flies and disease. But the Peruvian government wants to implement a plan to supply everyone with clean water over the next 3 years. DW correspondent Naomi Conrad brings us this report from a village on the outskirts of the capital, Lima.
Not long ago, the mafia ruled supreme over Huayacán's water supplies. Every couple of days, their lorries would trundle along Huayacán's dusty dirt roads and stop at the wooden and stone huts huddled in the valley. Maria would take her bucket, gingerly pick her way around the potholes and make her way down to the lorries.
We used to get the water down there. We bought it, you see.
Water was expensive. 10 soles a litre, almost 3 euros, Maria says. Today each house has its own water supply, provided by the governmental water agency SIDAPAL. Even Maria's tiny hut clinging to the barren mountainside has a tap. A litre of water costs about 3 soles. Maria's water is running into a blue bucket brimming with soapy dishwater. It's dripping over the rim, turning the dusty ground into frothy mud. Sometimes, Maria says, she forgets to pay her bill. She shrugs and rocks her crying baby. It's swaddled in a dusty brown blanket despite the dry midday heat. When people don't pay, SIDAPAL turns off the water within 3 days. Her neighbour, who's tightly clutching her grandson's hand, nods emphatically.
Then you have to ask your neighbour for water. We share whatever we have.
It's expensive to reconnect the water, Maria says. Almost 100 soles, 30 euros. Can she afford it? Maria shrugs. She's standing outside her tiny one-room shop. A few bars of soap and faded packets of biscuits are haphazardly stacked along the dusty counter. Her neighbour chips in.
We need to be careful. Not watch TV too much. Turn the lights off.
But they agree. They make do.
There is real poverty here.
Carmela Gabonal is a social worker from Lima.
These people work on construction sites or are street hawkers, but they do have some means.
The water, Gabonal says, readjusting her blue cap, has brought some modest development. When Sidapal laid the pipes, the workers also filled up the many potholes and evened out the dirt tracks. The village, Gabonal says, owes these modest developments to the government agency Sidapal. And its wiry and energetic director, Eduardo Cascon, who took over the agency a year ago. He took over a daunting job. Almost 40% of Lima's inhabitants still don't have access to safe drinking water and proper sewage systems. Almost 1 million people depend on the water mafia, or makeshift wells.
Van las ratas, las moscas, esto trae enfermedades, y sobre todo en el verano, los niños, la gente mayor, se enferma. Y uno gasta más curando a las personas de lo que se gastaría invirtiendo en el sistema de saneamiento.
Some 5 years ago, the Peruvian government launched the program Agua para Todos, Water for All. In only 3 years, Cascon wants to supply every limeño, as the people in Peru's capital are called, with clean drinking water. Not an easy task. Lima is situated in the desert.
Estamos en una zona de alto estrés hídrico.
This is a zone with extreme water shortages. I'd say the best comparison we have is Cairo. Cairo has 15 million inhabitants and lies in the desert, but it has the Nile with some 2,840 cubic meters flowing through it per second. Now, we have 9 million inhabitants, but our river, at its most extreme, has only 10 cubic meters per second, and we don't have many water supplies.
Cascon smiles, but it's a weary smile. He spends his days fighting with ministers for more funds and trying to weed out the corruption in his agency. Sometimes, when he gets home late at night, Cascon dreams of the private university where he headed the engineering department. Just thinking about how much water is simply wasted makes him feel tired.
There is just so much inefficiency of water consumption in Lima. Why? Because water is so cheap for everyone. That's just not right.
In Lima, the average water consumption is about 240 litres a day, Cascon says. In Germany, he's quick to point out, it's only half of that. Sidapal pays some 20, sometimes even 30 soles a litre to supply isolated communities with water. The consumers pay only 3 soles. Cascon would like to increase the price, but he can't. Water in Peru is too political. Increase the rates, he says wryly, and people protest. But the pressure on Cascon and Sidapal is increasing. Ever more people are streaming to Lima. Entire new settlements appear overnight, organized invasiones or illegal land invasions. Families stake out small parcels of land and soon demand water and electricity for their hastily constructed huts. Water that is increasingly turning into a rare commodity.
Our reservoirs are running low. It's not raining enough anymore, and our lagunes are drying out. Most people aren't even aware of the danger Lima's in.
Take Maria. She isn't aware that the water supplies are running low, but she, for one, is taking care not to use too much water. Otherwise, Sidapal will once again turn her water off, and she will have to take a bucket and beg her neighbours for water. For DW, this is Naomi Conrad in Huayacán, Peru.
Para componer un son, se necesita un motivo y un tema constructivo y también inspiración. Es como hacer un sazón con todos los ingredientes. Ahí tienes que ser paciente, si no se te va la mano. Y el bailar que no baila, no puede gozar, hermano. Óyelo bien. Para componer un son.
A cut of music there from Ismael Miranda and Cecilia Noel, Así se compone un son.
We leave the chilly glacial mountains of the Andes now and hurry indoors into a recycled home in the Scottish countryside. Recycling materials saves energy and resources, and it keeps useful goods from winding up in landfill. It's also a super way to prolong the life of cast-off materials, reusing them in the walls and floors of sustainable recycled homes. In our next piece here on Living Planet, we're going to visit the home of Alistair Dawson. After 5 years of hard work, the Scottish farmer has made his vision of ecological living a reality. Irene Quayle has more.
Beautiful spot. Actually, it's perfect weather today. We're standing in front of a project which you've been working on for quite a long time.
Yes, I decided to diversify the core farm business and build a holiday lodge accommodation. And the project's kind of grown arms and legs since its initial idea. And I've built a structure that's typically called an earthship. And it's using reclaimed, recycled and materials that are low embodied. And the basic principles that we have with the airship is that it's passive solar, so it relies heavily on the radiation from the sun. And so the structure is south-facing to face the sun, and it's mostly glazed to the south.
So how did you have the idea of doing something like this?
Being a farmer, I'm very conscious of the nature and the environment, and farmers typically they look very, very long term. You don't own land; you're just a beneficiary. You're there as a caretaker for the next generation.
And all these stones on the outside, it looks very attractive, but that's all recycled from somewhere.
Yes, this is there've been a tram system put in Edinburgh. And a lot of the Whin cobblestones and also some of the granite cobblestones were lifted, and we've used some of them in the wall. We've also used it on the farm dike stone, and also some reclaimed Caithness flagstone on its side. So it's came up. It's kind of bluey grey nature, and it really sits very well into the topography of the landscape, and that was one of the conditions of planning, was that we were situated here on the side of a hillside looking out over a valley, and we're in a very visible location, and the planners were concerned with that, so they required a design that didn't interrupt the land forum. We're in the inside of the structure now. It's a diaphragm roof. The ceiling is curved down from the centre. I wanted it to be curved, more of a kind of a softer, you know, feel to it. Like it was giving you a big hug when you entered the structure. So the curved walls made the building of it far more difficult than a regular straight wall. And the floor, as you can see, it's got all the different colours in it. It's a maple-based floor, but it came from a school, a gymnasium, locally. And we've just retained the different colours. But it's very much a kind of open plan area. We've got a living dining area, and also we have a small wood-burning stove that is there for a bit of thermal comfort in the winter time, but also the aesthetic aspect. But we have a controlled ventilation system that's mechanically operated, and that allows the stale, moist air to be sucked out of the structure, and fresh air is brought in. The clay in the rammed earth wall also acts as a humidity buffer.
What kind of a reaction do you get from the other, like, conventional farmers around?
Well, they think I'm a bit mad, and I have bored quite a few people at various parties with my project here. Most of my friends and my family give me a wide berth, but ultimately they're going to come and pay me a visit and walk round and experience the earthship, so they'll realise then that I'm not all talk and no action. So.
It's also an absolutely fantastic view that whoever is living in this earthship is going to have.
Yes, I suppose we have to, you know, it's a diversified business, so we have to attract people here. And we're fortunate we're close to the main transport links, and also Edinburgh is a big attraction. They're going to come and live on an organic livestock farm and enjoy living in environmental equilibrium in an earthship, and just experience it for a week of their lives. And you never know, they might want to build one themselves in the future.
Thank you to Irene Quayle for that report. I'm Saroja Quayle. You're listening to Living Planet. Our last piece on today's show takes us to the site of one of the worst industrial accidents in history, Bhopal. The city is the capital of Madhya Pradesh, a largely rural state in the heart of India. When Union Carbide, which is now part of Dow Chemical, opened a facility there, locals began to imagine new futures for themselves. Jobs, they thought. Prosperity, education, new opportunities. But instead, the facility brought poison, illness, and death. On the night of December 2, 1984, a highly toxic chemical called methyl isocyanate leaked from a tank, releasing a plume of toxic gas that wafted over the city. The government of Madhya Pradesh says some 4,000 people were killed. Greenpeace says that number grew to 8,000 as more died from the after effects of exposure. Union Carbide was bought by Dow Chemical in 2001. The company has always claimed that the leak was the result of sabotage, but evidence points to poor safety procedures and maintenance. Advocacy groups have lobbied for years for tougher action against Union Carbide and Dow, and its chief executive at the time, Warren Anderson. Anderson is wanted in India to face charges of homicide, but the government has been unable to secure extradition. We are going to visit the site now in a special report from Leila Knuppel. The English version has been read by Andreas Grigo.
Hazira B is visiting a neighborhood in the north of Bhopal city. A crowd surrounds her, men with serious faces, women in colorful saris. Today, the 57-year-old activist confirms what many of them have suspected all along. Their drinking water is contaminated with lead and other heavy metals and toxic substances. Not far from here, harmful chemicals are seeping into the groundwater from the old Union Carbide pesticide plant. Hazira B says the US-based company dumped its waste just there for years. Some of the communities around Bhopal now receive clean water from outside the city. After years of protest and a verdict from the Supreme Court, the government installed new pipes, bringing in water from 50 kilometers away. But much to the dismay of the residents, not all the communities here are able to access that water. Environmental activists say the contaminated groundwater is spreading, affecting some 60,000 people in the area. Hazira B has campaigned for years, demanding that Union Carbide and its legal successor, Dow Chemical, clean up the dump site.
Dow Chemical should take all the chemical waste back to the U.S. and process it there. The Indian government has to increase pressure on those who are responsible.
It's been nearly three decades since the disaster at Bhopal. On the night of December 2, 1984, when most people were sleeping, a tank at the plant sprung a leak. People woke up coughing. They jumped up from their beds, their eyes and throats burning. Some choked on their own bile. As people ran, families were divided from each other. Others collapsed in pain and were trampled. The Union Carbide plant spewed out 40 tons of highly toxic methyl isocyanate. 20,000 people died, and hundreds of thousands of survivors are still sick. They have respiratory diseases, eye problems, high blood pressure. Some suffer from infertility. The plant has long been closed. The compound is surrounded by green trees. Rusty pipes and tanks stand out between pale patches of grass. A few goats graze nearby, while children play cricket. In theory, it's prohibited for anyone to enter the property, but here hardly anyone cares. The high walls surrounding the factory have been damaged or removed at several points. The barbed wire around the entrance folded down. T.R. Chowan used to work at the Union Carbide plant, operating some of its machinery.
We are operating the plant, pressure control, temperature control, flow controls.
Together with him, we visit some of the places where he used to work.
Now we'll go to the operation barn. This local pit.
Johan takes the car to the southern tip of the factory compound. This is, he says, where Union Carbide dumped most of their waste. At first, the chemicals were just dumped on the grounds here. Later on, they were poured in what is called a solar evaporation pond.
Solar evaporation pond is also simple. They dig out the pond on the ground and just put a thin plastic film on the ground to avoid, and it's a damage at various points. So it's also polluting the underground water through a solar evaporation pond also.
The pond is filled with black, murky water. The air has a faintly acrid smell. Again, children are playing just nearby. John says the disaster here has left a legacy that will continue to have an impact for generations.
This whole area is contaminated.
He says everything here is still contaminated. Rachna Dingra studies a map of the old Union Carbide compound. For years, the activist has been trying to find out what is really hidden in the soil, silently rotting away. She wants to know what is leaking into the groundwater. Dingra is a chief coordinator of the International Campaign for Justice in Bhopal. In 1990, the organization had taken soil samples and sent them off to Boston for analysis.
Some of these chemicals are heavy metals like lead and mercury. You know, mercury is a neurotoxin. Some of these are teratogenic chemicals. Basically, it will go through the placenta barrier, so it is potentially causing damage to unborn. Then there are these aldicarb and carbaryl, all of them known to cause damage to liver, lungs, eyes, kidney, brain.
Two reports by Greenpeace, as well as one by the Institute of Toxicology, ordered by the Indian government, came to similar conclusions by providing evidence of many of these substances in both the soil and the water. Since the catastrophe, very little has been done to clean up the Union Carbide factory. If you cast a look over the deserted grounds, it's like the place has been frozen in time for almost two decades. Brown glass pharmacy jars are collecting dust on the shelves. Tree branches and bushes have stretched in through broken glass windows. For years now, the activists have been fighting with the Indian government, demanding the site to be cleaned properly. But the government doesn't have the necessary facilities for a cleanup on this scale. Germany offered to step in. The highly toxic waste was to be taken to the German city of Hamburg for processing. But the deal fell through when German officials decided it would be too expensive and far too dangerous. So the residents of Bhopal are still living side by side with Union Carbide's toxic waste.
A report there from Leila Knüppel. The English version was read by Andreas Grigo. And that brings us to the end of another edition of Living Planet. I'm Saroja Coelho. I'll be back again next week with more news and stories about the environment. In the meantime, you can find us online at dw.de/environment. From everyone here in studio, thanks for listening.